Good morning, this is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, February 6th, a snowy Saturday. Excuse me. What a week. Yet another chaotic and possibly historic one because the debt issue worldwide came into focus as a combination of concerns over the likes of Greece, Spain, and Portugal, combined with the release of President Obama's fiscal 2011 budget, and the massive deficits contained therein caused many to wonder if we've finally crossed the point of no return. It was this, along with some unsettling developments on the China front, that had the stock market gasping for air, with the Dow Jones falling below 10,000 before recovering a bit late Friday in a pure bout of blatant market manipulation. What was striking in the discussion is that while the United States economy is in no way Greece, we share a certain kinship in that our projected budget deficits are essentially the same. Ours could be close to 11% of GDP in 2011, and Greece's is in the 12% neighborhood, similar to Spain and Portugal as well, while the other pigs, Italy and Ireland, aren't exactly role models in their own right. For years I've written that the deficits in this country did not matter in the short and medium term when it came to the performance of the stock market, which is the bottom line for stocks and news. I always said there would come a time when we would pay the piper, but there was zero reason to lose sleep over it today. We've had far more pressing issues, from the collapse of the tech bubble, 9/11 Iraq, the housing bubble, the financial crisis Iran, etc. I've also been adamant that more time was wasted wringing one's hands over the plight of the U.S. dollar than was warranted, and on both topics I've been bang on. Regarding the latter, in particular this past year, as one commentator after another foretold the collapse of the greenback, I stood firm. You've all noticed what's happened the past few weeks, no doubt. The dollar bears and their commodity brethren have been crushed because, like it or not, the United States is still the safest bet in town, even with our massive debts. It's really a pretty simple story. I can't believe how many missed it. But with this week's change in sentiment concerning the twin deficits, both fiscal and national, we are indeed closer to the day when all hell could break loose, when capital will flee the greenback and return home, like to Japan and China. Not all of it, of course, but enough to make a difference. However, I'm still not going to lose much sleep over it. The more important issue for today is just where the global recovery is headed, and that's where the situation in the Eurozone is, in particular, is important. Problems there, while benefiting the dollar, can lead to a big drop in confidence. While you'll never hear the White House say this, a rising stock market is critical to sustaining our recovery. If out of nowhere the Dow Jones were to drop from 10,000 to 8,000, for instance, for whatever reason, possibly geopolitical, a true depression, not just a double dip, would be a virtual guarantee. For starters, it would foretell a second collapse in housing. One other item. This week saw the return of the credit default swap market with a vengeance, where speculators, pure and simple, can roil markets much as they did in the fall of 2008. Why these quote, insurance policies are even in existence has long been a mystery to me. There is zero economic reason for them. Let the market price risk in corp bonds and sovereign debt through repricing and increases in yields. It worked for over 100 years until the introduction of this crap, where in many a case you have no idea who is on the other side of the trade and whether you'd get paid, even if you're right. It's insane. It's what killed AIG, and you all know how a bunch of so-called geniuses in a small department there almost brought down our entire financial system. For a while this week, it looked like it was happening all over again. Moving along, editorial Washington Post on the just-concluded Davos gathering. Harvard economist Kenneth Rogoff kicked off the discussion with a simple, depressing argument. The banking collapse is morphing into a long-term crisis of government debt. Instead of financial panic, we now face an illusion of normalcy, with governments stepping in to guarantee everything. They've succeeded in fending off another Great Depression, but at the cost of skyrocketing debt. And if history is any guide, he said, financial crises are often followed precisely by a wave of sovereign debt crises a few years later. In countries like the United States and Britain, I'm not talking about default, but we certainly may have to see very painful political crises, Rogoff predicted. Belt tightening, higher taxes, slower growth. That was the Washington Post and Kenneth Rogoff. So let's take one example of where we're headed. The fiscal 2011 budget submitted by President Obama this week, with the Wall Street Journal described as one of the greatest spend-while-you-can documents in American history. $3.8 trillion in spending in 2011, or 25.4% as a share of the U.S. economy, a post-World War II record. The 40-year average is 20.7%. The Journal editorializes, if this budget is Mr. Obama's first clear demonstration of his long-term governing priorities, then it's hard not to conclude that this spending boom is deliberate. It is an effort to put in place programs and spending commitments that will require vast new tax increases and give the political class a claim on far more private American wealth. Despite talk of tough choices in yesterday's document, the administration wants $25 billion in new spending for states for Medicaid, $100 billion for yet another jobs stimulus, big boost in spending for low-income family programs, for health research, heating assistance, and education. If Mr. Obama's priorities become law, federal outlays will have grown an astonishing 29% since 2008. That's hardly the stuff of Kenneth Rogoff's belt tightening, but we will have higher taxes and slower growth. The Obama budget contains about $2 trillion in tax increases over the coming decade. $1 trillion of this coming by reinstating 10-year-old income tax rates of 36 and 39.6% from 33 and 36 for single Americans earning more than $200,000 and joint filers who make more than $250,000. In addition, the top capital gains rate will revert back to 20% from 15% today, all to take effect next January 1st. Obama cut taxes some for those earning under $200,000 and talks of tax reductions for small business, but the latter actually receives a tax increase. Even with projected increased revenues in other areas, the accumulated deficits over the decade are forecast to add up to $8.5 trillion. Of course, Congress still gets a chance to work its magic, and you can be sure spending will be even higher than the administration wants, it being an election year and all, and there could be another tax or two thrown in for good measure, see big oil and the banks, and that's hardly a job creator. In fact, with all the uncertainty these days between Washington, the sovereign debt issue, and a rambunctious China, if you're a CEO, why would you take a chance and do a lot of hiring? Oh, I'll get to Cisco's John Chambers in a bit. The news wasn't all bad this week, but in a survey by PricewaterhouseCoopers for the Davos conference, one in four CEOs worldwide said they planned on cutting their payrolls further in 2010. A rousing global recovery? I think not, once we get beyond the current inventory readjustment. Gerald Tsai, Wall Street Journal, on a threat posed by rising deficits. The federal budget deficit has long since graduated from nuisance to headache to pressing national concern. Now, however, it has become so large and persistent that it is time to start thinking of it as something else entirely, a national security threat. The U.S. government this year will borrow one of every $3 it spends, with many of those funds coming from foreign countries. That weakens America's standing and its freedom to act, strengthens China and other world powers, puts long-term defense spending at risk, undermines the power of the American system as a model for developing countries, and reduces the aura of power that has been a great intangible asset for presidents for more than a century. We've reached a point now where there is an intimate link between our solvency and our national security, says Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations and the senior national security advisor in both the first and second Bush presidencies. What's so discouraging is that our domestic politics don't seem to be up to the challenge, says Haass. Bingo. Not a lot of profiles encourage these days, sports fans. Gerald Seib continues, consider just four of the ways that budget deficits also threaten America's national security. They make America vulnerable to foreign pressures. The U.S. has about $7.5 trillion in accumulated debt held by the public, about half of that in the hands of investors abroad. That means America's government is dependent on the largesse of foreign creditors and subject to the whims of international financial markets. Chinese power is growing as a result. A lot of the deficit is being financed by China. Just this weekend, for example, the U.S. angered China by agreeing to sell Taiwan $6.4 billion in arms. At some point, will the U.S. face economic servitude to China that would make such a policy decision impossible? Long-term national security budgets are put at risk. The U.S. will spend a once unthinkable $688 billion on defense this year owing to Iraq and Afghanistan. Before September 11th, 2001, the figure was closer to $300 billion. The American model is being undermined before the rest of the world. This is the great intangible impact of yawning budget deficits. The image of an invincible America had two large effects over the last century or so. First, it made other countries listen when Washington talked, and second, it often, not always of course, but often made other peoples and the leaders yearn to be like America. Saib concludes, sometimes that produced jealousy and resentment among leaders, but often it drew to the top of foreign lands leaders who admired the U.S. and wanted their countries to emulate it. Such leaders are good allies. Well, what of the good news this week? After all, there was some. Cisco Systems, for one, didn't just beat the street with its quarterly earnings, but CEO John Chambers said his company was hiring 2,000 to 3,000 over the coming year because of, quote, one of the most robust turnarounds I've seen in my career. Cisco saw growth across all product lines, coupled with a solid report from Intel the other week. Is business spending returning, or is it just a one-off in the case of a few tech heavyweights? The news on earnings overall has been excellent, with 75% of the S&P 500 reporting thus far exceeding on the bottom line and 70% beating on the top line revenues. Not bad. Not bad at all. But with few exceptions, we're hardly getting the all clear. And how can we, with all the uncertainty around? Yes, CapEx is growing at its fastest rate since 2006, but that's mostly in tech land, and we're nowhere near old peaks in production. Plus, it's the consumer that still drives things. What is he concerned with? Jobs and housing. Regarding the labor market, the January employment data released on Friday showed another job loss for the month, 20,000, but a big upward revision, more jobs lost for December, along with an annual revision in the labor figures. That bottom line means we've lost 8.4 million jobs in total since the start of the recession. But the headline will be that the unemployment rate ticked down to 9.7%. The real rate remains closer to 17%. The 9.7 is like a Russian judge awarding his countrymen when the guy actually fell off the parallel bars and broke his neck. Total BS. Why? Because after seeing solid progress late last year in terms of the weekly jobless claims figures, a more accurate data point, it's stalled. Now, if we get more news like that distributed by Cisco, I'll change my tune a bit on this front. I do have to note that the January ISM figures on manufacturing came in at a far better than expected 58.4, and there were similarly strong figures around the world. China 55.8, India 57.7, UK 56.7, and Taiwan 61.7. So this is good. I'm just curious what the figures will be in April and May, which will go a long ways in telling us how the second half of the year will shape up. But back in the States, there's housing. My mantra, going back to 2008, was we'd bottom in terms of median home prices in April, May 09, and that indeed was the case. Then I said we'd sit there for an extended period. So what I found mildly amusing, given the topic, was how every major publication in the last 2 weeks has had a story on homeowners walking away from their mortgage. To wit, the threshold seems to be when the home's value falls below 75% of the amount owed, the point at which the homeowner has to think about walking away. By the third quarter of 2009, an estimated 4.5 million homeowners had reached this mark, and now this figure is slated to peak at 5.1 million by June, or about 10% of all Americans with mortgages. 25% overall are underwater. Bottom line, anyone calling for a rebound in home prices anytime soon is absolutely nuts. Not that I've seen a single expert say this recently. The shills of 2005-06 learned a hard lesson and in many a case have been reduced to shoveling snow in the mid-Atlantic this weekend. Everything I've talked about thus far is about the wealth effect. So with the labor market that in no way is close to turning around in earnest and housing still a huge issue and obviously not a source of cash, those calling for solid growth in the U.S. economy in the second half of 2010 simply aren't being honest. If I see things really improve, which means I have to also see a resolution to my geopolitical concerns, then I'll change my forecast. It would help for starters if President Obama would recognize the opportunity he has to bring about change in Iran, but it's doubtful. Stocks finished lower a fourth consecutive week, the worst such streak since last March's lows, with the Dow Jones closing at 10,012 and needing a last-hour rally to get there, down 0.6%. while the S&P 500 lost 0.7% for the week and NASDAQ just 0.3%, recovering from heavy losses even after Cisco's terrific report. I'll be back with you next Saturday, February 13th. Have a great week.